Hey y'all, Chris again. So we are going to be picking up where we left off, leading into movement of a hand. So this is part two of three. If you haven't already listened to the first part, I highly suggest you go back and do that. But you're your own person. You have personal agency, so do whatever feels right to you. Don't want to waste too much time because, of course, we have a lot to get to. So without further ado, let's get into it.
And here we are at track five, the movement of a hand. This one is, I don't really have too many notes for this particular song. I don't know about you, but I found that it's a really interestingly placed song in that it feels almost a bit of a break. Like it still has heavy themes and subject matter, but it's just a little more soothing than the other songs that we've gotten so far.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I don't have too many notes, but I do also think that this is a song that helps strengthen one of my symbols, which is the idea of death being water. Before I get there, though, I just to go throughout the song chronologically, I think the music box comes back here. There's a very similar rhythm in the background. It's not the same melody, but the rhythm itself is very much mirrored to Spindle Darkness Fever Necklace. And very explicitly in the lyrics, he says, "Tiny bells with moving parts bounces off of the painted porcelain, a tiny dancing doll." I don't know if there's really another way to interpret it besides that being a music box. So about death and water. So the lyrics, "You lay your head onto my shoulder and pour like water over me. If I just exist for the next 10 minutes of this drive, that will be fine. And all these trees that line this curb will be rejoicing and alive." I know that you could read this as pouring like water is our tears, but it also makes me think a little bit about decomposition, right? So nourishing the trees, and just like when you go, if your body decomposes into the earth, your nutrients go into the soil, and people talk about how they want to be reborn as a tree or whatever, or however you want to phrase it. And the idea of nourishing the wildlife in the same way water does. The other part about it too, "Soon all the joy that pours from everything makes fountains of your eyes because you finally understand the movement of a hand waving goodbye." So I get the imagery of like driving someone to their death, maybe not literally, but almost like sort of putting a pet down. And there's this reminiscence of the good times and the peacefulness before the end comes, maybe like a honeymoon period before halai, 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 where the relationship ends in a funeral.
Okay, so unrelated. I need to pick up my phone again and I need to make another call completely unrelated to a previous bit that we've done because clearly you haven't taken the words out of my mouth.
I'd apologize, but I'm not sorry.
But no, I've grown to accept this. No, but big old but here. I think that one divergence I'm going to make from your interpretation is I think that this drive in question is the end of the relationship.
Okay.
So I have in my notes that one of my this might be my favorite description of love in any song. Just that image of somebody's head on your shoulder and then the willingness to be to have your existence boil down to a 10-minute drive is maybe one of my favorite ways to describe what it's like to love someone. And maybe I'm projecting, but just that if you've ever been in a moment where like someone that you really care about is has that intimate moment where like they have a head on your shoulder or you have your arm around them and you're doing everything possible to make that moment last. And you would be perfectly okay with that being your existence. just A plus, lovely, like, love struck imagery right there.
Yeah.
And where I see that this drive is sort of like the end of the relationship is, I think the way that that last stanza is worded, soon all the joy that pours from everything, it's pouring from it, which means the joy is leaving, makes fountains of your eyes. This joy is leaving you, and mm-hmm. you're crying, and you're finally understanding at the end of this drive, that person gets out of the car, and they wave goodbye, and you understand, that's it. That's goodbye. And the way that I'm interpreting that is at odds with how calming the song is. But right. also, if you listen, like, it is very discordant at the end, right? Like, there is something, there are some jarring notes. Again, I'm a layman when it comes to music, and I don't have an ear for the subtleties of the music here. But I do definitely hear, like, there's something more unsettling with those deep notes at the end that contrast with the higher notes that make me think, like, it very well represents the bittersweetness of, you had this lovely moment, you still care about this person, but they're gone.
And I'm trying to play the song in my head. Do, do, do,
yep.
do, do. Yeah. No, it's pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think we do end up on, really at the same point, just with the difference being like, is this the end of the relationship or is this the reminiscence? And really, in a sense, I think we both kind of approach it from the standpoint of the relationship being over. And it's a minute difference, if that. And otherwise, I stole those words yet again. And I am sorry for that. But I think... Now that we are not technically at the halfway point, but 5 of 11, how we kind of thought we would go similar places. And for the most part, we've had those, you know, slight divergences and things like that. But our readings are tending to be relatively similar, or at least around the same topics and same points.
Right. For people who purposefully did not coordinate this, we're somehow hitting the same beats.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, if people don't believe us, well, screw you, huh?
You can go ahead and suck an egg.
All right. Let's get back to the topic at hand, because I'm sure people want to hear more about this next song. Because it is a hugely important song in the context of the story of the album, and that is Arionette.
Yeah, this song is interesting, I think, for quite a few reasons. And one is that
it's meaty.
It is very, very meaty. There's something like almost gothic horror to this song that is, it kind of sets it apart from various others. It does have a weird, maybe weird is an unkind word, but it has this really epic, almost Victorian way of describing very mundane, sad things. I think the language of this song is a little unusual for the rest of the track, which makes it stand out. I think that's to its benefit, frankly. And also in the its explicit reference in the fake interview, which I guess we'll get to eventually.
So tell me, Jesse, who is this Arionette? How does she fit into all of this?
Well, I don't really want to talk about her in case she's listening.
So she's a real person?
No, I made her up.
So she's not real?
As real as you or I.
I'm not sure I understand.
Do you want to dance? was that the line where you asked, do you want to dance, or was that a different
one? It was a little bit later.
Yeah, I love that. Until yeah. You pointed it out to me, I actually never noticed that he said that. Anyway.
Yeah, he, it's they go on a little bit. Connor goes Just as real. No, I think that's later because he says, just as real as you are, I'm not sure I understand. And Connor goes, neither do I, but when I grow up, I will. I mean, a lot of things are just really unclear for me right now. And then that's what he yeah. asks. So you mentioned your depression, and fake Connor goes, no, I didn't. it's so good.
It's a very, very, okay. So I think that interview, when we eventually get there, does what I think this song is doing, which, okay, so if people who know me, IRL, will know that I'm a huge fan of James Joyce. And there is, sorry, I'm gonna be doing this again. So I tried to bring in literature from when we were talking about Every Day and Every Night. And there is a particular scene in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man where the character, the main character, Stephen, who is basically a stand-in for Joyce, and the novel centers around this young man's sort of sexual and artistic awakening. And him becoming a writer. And he imagines the epiphany that inspires him to make art and to be a writer as this sort of phantom girl on a beach. And just the sight of this like young, beautiful girl coming to him in this the almost divine moment is that's what solidifies the idea that he must become an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a similar thing going on here in that I don't think that fake interview with Connor Oberst is really off the mark when he talks about how Arionette's not a real person. He's worried that she will listen in on the conversation and that just because he made her up doesn't make her any less real than we are. And I think if you look at the Arionette as sort of like an ideal or maybe a stand-in for a one person or maybe a collection of people in, we'll say, actual Connor Oberst's life and fictionalizes them into this character of Arionette, I think we get that weird interplay of it's both fake and real and ideal and a reflection, not unlike a mirror.
So I think this is finally one of these spots where we'll diverge again.
Mm.
Because, so I'm stealing a little bit of this from actually the Genius annotation for Arionette. So just the concept of the name Arionette. And I'm kind of filling the rest of it in with what I will say is my own interpretation. So the words aria and marionette, song and a puppet. So Arionette is a song puppet. You know, is it a muse? Is it some sort of way of personifying Connor's use of himself or his trauma rather as a puppet in his songs? And so I think it is a way for Connor to, I'll say, personify again those grievances that he has with putting himself on display and putting his trauma on display. So Arionette serves as a literal plot device in that sense.
No, and I totally see that. And I don't think that that our two perspectives conflict or contradict each other that much.
Yeah.
Because then you could say that the fact that this fictional character is a stand-in for either a real person or a collection of people or experiences, that might tie into what we had discussed with the calendar hung itself. I keep getting tripped up because I keep wanting to say the calendar hanged itself because I'm a I'm a pedant. So
it's like drug and dragged, huh?
Right. Yeah, exactly. We can get into that whole debacle again. But the fact that that character didn't get a name in the calendar hung itself. It was always just a you.
Right.
So I think it's the fact that we're naming this character now, or a potential stand-in for that character, in a song that really dramatizes and puts beautiful language to the pettiness that can be gossip or teenage or adolescent social interactions, or how people just have this really toxic relationship with prying into other people's business. And as the kids like to say these days, spilling the tea. Like this image of fragile, leprous people trading like secrets and darkness as currency. These wretched creatures. Like, is that how Connor sees the grim spectacle of watching an artist pour their heart out into work? Mm-hmm. Maybe not necessarily all the time, but certainly putting yourself in that position and watching people kind of spoon it up, I would imagine would be pretty unsettling for an artist, even if that is your intention to put that hurt out there. You know what right. I mean?
Yeah, and I agree with that. So that line, fragile keep secrets, gathered in pockets, they'll sell them for nothing, a cheap watch, a locket. Also, that next line, that kind of gold washes off. So I agree with what you're saying there. I think there is kind of thinking about the cheapness of these accomplishments, how they're novel, not permanent. And I think he's saying that the praise that he is receiving is not worth him exposing those secrets, because he is, before I had mentioned, one of the stories that Connor was telling is that there's some kind of event, some secret. And the way that he is describing it in here, so the fragile keep secrets gathered in pockets, they'll sell them. They're selling these secrets. I think that's a way for Connor to say that he's selling his trauma. He's selling these events literally through music sales, and he's feeling a little jaded, disillusioned, probably the better word to use, just with the idea of trading his personal life for what he thinks is just cheap cash, fame, as slight as it may be at this point.
And I'm curious, if do you think that maybe the creation of the character, whether it's like on more on your end of being a literal plot device, especially like I didn't look at the that note for genius, so I didn't see that particular reading of the name, but that's really interesting, like that kind of pun in the name.
Right.
Do you think that that's a justification for it? Because there is something compelling about the way that he talks to Arionette in the song. Like, stay with me. It seems to be like the only real thing, because everything else seems hostile. And, oh, stay with me, Arionette, until the wolves are away, as though Arionette is something that protects him, or at least offers him more comfort than these trinkets with their painted gold.
Yeah, that's kind of bringing something new up for me, or I guess kind of further forming an idea that I had. So one of the things I haven't brought up yet was this idea that Connor seems to be consistently putting women on display, or almost like on a pedestal throughout the album, with music boxes, or later in Center of the World when he talks about a statue. Of course, when the curious girl realizes she's under glass. And I wonder, too, the choice to make Arionette presumably female as well. I feel like maybe Connor is thinking about his use of women as plot devices, really, in the sense that they both exist as a way for him to air his grievances, his sadness, but also as a way of describing hope, right? It's, oh, that she broke my heart, but also, wait, where's the next girl? So I wonder if this kind of, if we want to get really, really meta with it almost, this idea of if Arionette is a plot device, maybe he is thinking about the fact that he does use women as basically reduces them down to points in his story. And I don't know, maybe contending with that a little bit on the song. Stay with me, Arionette, because she can both be hope and she can also be the hurt that he has felt.
Yeah. And I mean, if we want to continue to dive down this meta rabbit hole, and so forgive me if maybe I'm repeating what you said. I hope that I'm adding something to it and I'm not just repeating. But like,
honestly, repeat it because I truly probably don't know what I just said.
actually, that might be helpful. So there's the idea that this is sort of meta in that Connor is talking about the fact that these women are like, there's the tug and pull of them being redemptive, comforting figures. And then the cause for the need of those comforting figures. And we can maybe go a couple of layers deeper in that. Like, maybe he's now criticizing himself for using that trope in his songs.
Right.
The other layer of, then he's criticizing himself, Connor Oberst, the person, for maybe using or seeing women as those both things, needing them for comfort and also having some, you know, discomfort or hostility towards women for, you know, fucking motorcycle, for some perceived wrongdoing in the past. And then like sort of meta acknowledging that, like, I'm doing that, I'm using it in my song, and I'm aware that this is all a trope.
Yeah.
And it is wrapped up in a lot of, you know, I think if this song comes with, like I said before, it comes with its own strange way of talking about things. It comes with a unique anger and despair all wrapped up in one, in ways that even the next song I don't think really can contend with. Even though it's not like the most explicitly angry, there is something like uniquely, I don't know, there is some weird je ne sais quoi about this that kind of is a twist of the knife in the gut. And so keeping in mind with like this really interesting, unique way of talking about these experiences that we don't really, I personally don't see in the other songs, are there any like images or lines that jumped out at you and had you feeling a certain way from this song?
Yeah, I guess some of the other pieces, I really like the lines kind of finishing that first chorus when he talks about the stalks begin to sway. And so he brings up corn stalks. He's from Nebraska. So I think that might speak to or refer back to that idea I was talking about in Something Vague, where there's this past back in Omaha that he is no longer connected to. So those memories and whatever secret that he has and that whatever he continues to reference, even if it is multiple things, are still reaching him beyond the stalks, echoing. But ultimately, that's all that remains there, because he can't go back to the past, right? Which is something that we've discussed last episode. And this is something that Connor wishes you could do a little bit, is like, yeah, relive that, or try to go back, and fighting with the idea that no matter what you do, time pulls you forward.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's really interesting too, the bringing up the corn and the fact that he comes from Nebraska with those landlocked blues, your home as being your past, like your hometown and your home state being your past, and that the land, the corn stalks, are almost sort of rising up from the past and are haunting Connor in some way. The story,
the poison cornfields, man.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
a best friend backstab an abandoned train track. You're one of my kind, man.
When do we get into that album?
Yeah, that's a great way to open an album, but we'll save that for another time.
Another episode.
Yeah, but moving on from there, there is the line, "And the desperate are water. They run down forever. As they soak into silence, mend up together in a dark and distant place." And again, I read that, what I mentioned before, that he uses water as an allegory for death. I think this is, reading it that way fits very well. I'm not going to say that that's the only way to read that passage. But this idea of all of the desperate kind of rejoining each other at some point in a dark and distant place, running down into the ground, basically. And this idea of, you know, maybe he's not saying that there is an afterlife, but ultimately we'll all meet again, whether it's just the energy dissolving back into the earth, or, you know, if depending on your beliefs, if they'll be rejoined in this dark and distant place, which I don't know, is that hell? I hope not. Just all the desperate people end up in hell together. Oh God, save me.
All of our friends, we're all planning to meet, and we'll lay in bags as dead as leaves, all together for eternity. I think that's where we'll end up in the end.
Just in our sleeping bags. Honestly, what a way to go. If I could go back to some of those high school sleepovers, you know. Good times, man. You don't get to do that as an adult. That's just called having a roommate.
Yeah, that's called, we visited to see the concert, and I really don't feel like taking the train all the way home tonight. I'm just going to crash on your couch.
Yeah, no fanfare. Exactly.
The thing that you would get so excited for, the buildup of having a sleepover, or like, that's new and exciting, and now it's just mundane because we don't want to deal with the bullshit of public transit.
I still got pizza rolls, buddy, so yeah. Let's pop them in the microwave and burn the roofs of our mouths.
that sounds like, honestly, if you had told me that was from some like long-lost Connor lyric that you just dug up, I would completely believe you.
Oh, those are the scratched out lyrics in the notebook for Easy Lucky Free.
Oh, did you find that in one of these boxes down here?
Oh yeah, I was digging through. God, I found so much weird stuff.
Nancy doesn't throw anything away, does she?
I mean, that's pretty nice. It allows us to really dig up Connor's past.
Oh, sorry, Mrs. Oberst. I meant no disrespect. Sorry. I'm being too familiar.
She's not your friend.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I respect her as the woman whose house we're breaking into.
Oh, well. Well, all right. Bring us back on the rails.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, I was prepped and ready to start disagreeing with you about water being likened to death. And now I'm starting to have my mind changed, because just that idea of something desperately seeking the bottom of things is that's pretty compelling, because when it's first mentioned in I have to look up the title of the song again, "A Spindle of Darkness, a Fever and a Necklace," the necklace of sweat and the girls bringing water feel like it feels like life, because the girls are saying, like, don't do that. Don't kill yourself.
Right.
But at the same time, the fever, which you could argue is the album, is kind of a submission to that. Is kind of like the girls are saying, don't do this to yourself. Don't destroy yourself. And yet here's the album.
Right.
So I'm beginning to see that, I think I'm being like pulled to your side. I think that water is becoming like, it could be a source of life, and it could be a source of comfort, like a cool washcloth to your fevered head. But I think, the further in we get to the album, the more it becomes apparent that that imagery is now being used to represent the destruction of the self, especially mm-hmm. with that line of like the race to the bottom, essentially.
And I have some stuff in the next song that I think will tie in a little bit more with this, almost like it feels weird that because that line with girls bringing water and I'm saying that the girls bring death, like because it seems like this moment of hope, but it's also like almost this perversion of the idea of water being life in the next song, which I'm not ready to jump to just yet. But I will speak to some of that too. But I just wanted to make that note since you kind of brought it up. Because honestly, that is a very cool, perplexing line. And it's one that, you know, we've referenced multiple times, even though it's all the way back on track one.
I completely, well, maybe like completely agree. Is it like a really strong 180? From my original position, but
right.
I'm beginning to come around to your way of thinking, and that perversion I completely agree with. Mm-hmm. I think that Connor does a really good job at presenting that image of the girls with the water and perverting it. And then when you go through the album and then you go back to the top and you re-listen, that line has a different meaning. The hopefulness is still there, but you can, knowing what you know about water, and I'm pretty sure I know what you're going to talk about when we get to the next song, it changes the context of how you approach those lines. And mm-hmm. I think that makes for a really rewarding experience in art. Like any kind of art that you can go back and replay it, rewatch it, re-listen to it, and it has different meaning because of the knowledge that you already have, that makes for a really fun thing to interact and play with. And it's one of the reasons why I think I keep coming back to this album as much as I do, because even though it's emotionally taxing, I do get new things out of it with each listen.
And it's one of the reasons why we've had so much fun on this podcast.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I don't think we could really sustain this if we didn't bring the same amount of and same type of energy that we do. Folks, I mean, we don't really need to put that much extra energy or mindfulness into what we're saying. Besides trying to watch our verbal tics. If you were a fly on the wall listening to us geek out about this stuff normally, like it doesn't really sound too much different than, you know, you just have the benefit of us editing out our horrible jokes that we're like, we can't let people listen to that.
We can't
do that to you guys. We love you too much.
Well, the only other thing I have for this song is one, that line, the silver turns to gray. So don't leave me here with only mirrors watching me. This house, it holds nothing but the memories. And the moon, it leaves silver, but never sleeps. And the silver turns to gray. And then the final line, oh, stay with me, Arianette, until the wolves are away. Silver turning to gray, I think it's similar to that line earlier of the gold washing off. Mm-hmm. But the pairing of it with only mirrors watching me, it's like almost the shine of a mirror dulling, you know, because if the silver goes to gray, that luster is gone. And what are you left seeing in a dull mirror? Nothing, no reflection of yourself. And I'm wondering, like, is that what Connor wants? Because he talks on the second song about the disease you contract when you focus on what you're missing in a mirror. So is the mirror being gone what he truly wants? No self-reflection at all? Or is he disappointed by the fact that he's no longer able to look at himself anymore? And I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Well, I think that is a really interesting point. And I think that mirrors and identity and seeing oneself is definitely a huge factor in, and one of the huge tensions of the, I almost said the novel, of the album However, I think we should separate those lines. So, okay. I think, so don't leave me here with only mirrors watching me. This house holds nothing but the memories. Let's hold that as one thing. And the moon, it leaves silver, but never sleeps, and the silver turns to gray. I think we should isolate that because, so the thing that jumps out to me is the silver turning to gray. When silver oxidizes, we call that tarnishing. So that's naturally what happens with silver. Like, it's usually this bright, almost white luster. And then when you leave it out and you don't polish it, it turns like gray. It almost looks sooty. And we use the term tarnish.
All right, Dr. Jesse.
Listen, I have a master's degree in literature, so I know about chemistry.
Right.
naturally. So we also use the term tarnish to, like, when you've ruined something, or when something was once pure and now it is ruined, when something is bright silver and now it is gray. Maybe if then after we separate those and we bring them back together, maybe what is being tarnished is the image of the self. And not so much of I can't see myself, but I am now seeing myself in a dirty mirror, as though my concept of self, or even my, right, like how we talked previously about mirrors sort of reminding you of what you lack, that could be in a way the mirror becoming tarnished. That if a clear mirror shows you what you are, then a tarnished one maybe represents your worst qualities, or reminding you of what you don't have. Yeah, something to consider. Just another way to approach it.
So yeah, I think that is an interesting way with tarnishing and all that, and clearly one I was unaware of. But we do have potentially three different things, right? This idea of seeing nothing in the mirror. Is that what Connor wants? Is it not what he wants? Or is it the tarnishing where you have this warped perspective of yourself? So either way, I think the song kind of leaves you uneasy in a sense. This plea to Arionette, stay with me until the wolves are away. So, you know, going back, like if Arionette is this plot device of just a woman, a generic woman, if he's seeing her as hope, maybe he's wishing that this hope doesn't leave him, that he can get through this night. Because really, you know, you have the air, the atmosphere of night throughout the entire song, despite the fact that the moon, I believe, is only mentioned at the end. I'm not directly looking at the lyrics. So maybe he's saying if this hope can get him through the night, at least that, you know, there's tomorrow and sunshine is there, and at least you can survive again until the night hours creep in and the other thoughts start to creep in.
That is interesting, and I hadn't thought of it that way. And it does draw my attention to the fact that this really does add credence to the idea of Arionette being more of a plot device and more of a meta acknowledgement of the way that Connor is treating this character, because it's not stay with me, Arionette, full stop. It's stay with me until the wolves are away. So then what happens when the wolves are away? Do you disregard this person until the next time, and or person or character, or however you want to look at Arionette, until the next crisis? And then I need you back. I need you to help me through this crisis. Or I need...
Right.
Or maybe if we want to continue down the rabbit hole that we tried to abandon a little while ago, maybe that's also the meta of Arionette. Maybe it's not so much Arionette that is the object, but the desire for her. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe being you know, in love with being in love with someone, or infatuated with your infatuation with a person, and not necessarily who right. they are, but their function, which adds another complicated layer to an already complicated song.
It definitely speaks to, you know, if we do stick with that, it speaks to a naive way of thinking about things. One, that I myself have fallen into the trap, you know, that the idea of there is a woman to save you, right? That there is, when one thing doesn't work out, well, you have to hold out hope because the next good thing could be around the corner. So rather than maybe reflecting on what you could do to change, what you could do to be happier, it's putting that weight on this other person, this girl, etc. And with the meta reading of it, if Connor is coming to terms with that, criticizing it, or just like honestly mentioning it, you know, just saying like, this is something that I do, then maybe Connor is kind of just coming to terms with that throughout the song. You know, it obviously, this song holds a lot of weight on the album. It almost feels like a keystone. If you got information straight from Connor's brain, you would be able to crack the code of what the rest of Fevers and Mirrors is, you know?
I agree. And I think we'll definitely talk more about this when we get to it. But I kind of want to make the argument that we get that information, ironically, in the fake interview. But that'll be that's a little teaser for when we get there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've talked about this song more than we've talked about any song on the podcast thus far. So I'm ready to move on to the next, not because I want to limit what we're going to say, but because I think we spent time talking about the song and kind of larger theories about what this means for the rest of the album. I've said what I need to on this song. Are there any like remaining pieces, anything left for you on this?
No, I don't think so. I think that if we wanted to, we could absolutely spend. We could do like our 3-hour video essay on YouTube talking about this song. So I think we did a good job at presenting the most important parts of what we wanted to say about it. So I think I'm ready to move on to the next one.
All right, man, let's do it.
Well, let us get to the next song, which is a seamless transition. And there was no pause in between takes where I shattered glass and cut my foot. And we're going on to the next one. No interruptions.
I'm glad you finally let the curious girl out, though. I mean, that was, I can't believe you kept her under that glass for so long.
Yeah, she was under that glass, and I had to break it. And, you know, I think I did the right thing at great cost to my own selfhood. So, no, we are talking about when the curious girl realizes she is under glass, which I actually don't remember if Genius has this as like an annotation, because I'm going to be completely honest. I go to Genius, I trust the lyrics, so I just copy and paste it into a document and then I make my notes there. But
don't actually fully trust the Genius lyrics. I found some discrepancies.
Yeah, I'm sure. But yeah, I'm curious if you've got some thoughts on what's going on in the song, or if anything jumps out at you specifically.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to talk about is the title, right? When the curious girl realizes she's under glass. So one thing, you know, that I'd mentioned the last track was that idea of the woman on display. And if we want to follow this little meta narrative, if this curious girl is realizing she's under glass, maybe it's maybe not a specific woman, but the collective of Connor's love interests realizing that they have been put on display, almost untouchable, right? That if they're under glass, there's this idealized version of themselves for Connor to ogle at, and for Connor to look at, which is an unfair position, obviously, for them to be in. So just from the title alone, I think it's interesting. Again, thinking of it too, if Arionette is a plot device, that if Arionette could be the curious girl and he's further introspective about the way that he is treating women in his songs or in his personal life, which is a unfortunately typical commonplace thing for us to do, hashtag smash the patriarchy. There's a lot, I think, just in the title alone. I haven't even gotten into some of the stuff about the track, but I'm gonna flip it over to you.
I think that you bring up a very good point about like bringing in the meta narrative of the last song that we talked about, and talking about how this is kind of the natural progression of that thought. And I think before I had sort of looked at this album through that lens, I had originally interpreted this song, The Curious Girl Looking Out from Under Glass, as sort of a female, like, either love interest or friend or just somebody who lives in a very sheltered, protected, ignorant world. And
okay,
becoming aware of what mental illness can look like. And I get this image of like a perfectly put together mannequin in a mall, and just suddenly realizing, like, poking its head out and realizing, like, seeing the Hot Topic next door and being like, oh fuck, there's some dark stuff happening just next door that I never noticed. I know I'm using like a silly analogy here, but the idea that, like, to
you're not in Kansas anymore. You're not in Nebraska anymore.
Yeah, we're not in Omaha no more. or even just maybe a classmate who doesn't really understand the desperation of these feelings. To kind of borrow what you were saying about how a lot of young men sort of have this ideal and this not very healthy relationship with their female peers or love interests or what have you, if we're going to look at it from like the heteronormative standpoint, that if we're going to read this like idealized from that lens, we can then say that this might even be like a triumph, that sort of perverse reason why you would want to either like self-harm, or that the fantasy of suicide. And again, we gave our warnings. I'm not advocating for this kind of behavior or thought process, but I think a lot of people approach it in this weird, selfish, like, martyrdom of like, when I do this and when they see me like this, they will be sorry, or they will realize what has been wrong, or they will see me in this new light, this sacrifice or this martyr. And that's how I read it originally. And I think that you could still make the argument that that's what the song does. But when you think of it the other way, as far as like seeing how kind of desperate and creepy and weird it is, that maybe the girl looking out from the display case is not like, that's her. It's more on the side of her than it is on the side of Connor.
Right.
And I think now, being an older person who's like seen things and read things and listened to other people's perspectives, I can see both sides. But my original take was that sort of selfish martyrdom for the sake of getting somebody's attention or being seen for like the tragic person that you are.
What I think is interesting too, this is an idea that we kind of came up with on the fly. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say like, oh yes, this was all just off of the top of our heads. Like, there are nuggets of this in my notes, and I'm sure in yours as well. But this kind of like meta narrative, it's kind of cool how this is evolving and kind of like changing the way we have read the tracks, or at least enhancing the way we most recently read the tracks on the fly. that's kind of just like, if you want to get to use the word meta again, almost about this podcast itself. So I think that in and of itself is pretty cool. Kind of going back though to some of my original notes, because although I think that that overall reading can serve a purpose in terms of the context of the song within the entire album, I still think there are pieces in this song that are also worth highlighting. You know, for the in one way, I kind of, again, maybe a previous way you could say I read it, is that this song is seems like a breath of hope amongst the heaviness of other songs. And I know it's kind of this crooning, longing song, but towards the end, there's an idea of hope, no matter how naive it might be, right? Because naive in the sense that we've been discussing, is it right to see the abstract of women as hope? And a real quick thing to toss in there too is Ruba, the subject that he talks about in the song, does come back later in the album, and she is his hope. So it kind of speaks back to this idea of using women for the idea of hope.
Mm.
One of the lines that I really want to highlight is, no matter how I may wish for a coffin so clean, or these trees to undress all their leaves onto me, I put my face in the dirt and then finally I see the sky that has been avoiding me. Now, I see this as this is my tie-in with Girls Bringing Water, with Calendar Hung Itself, and being pulled from the grass where he was laid, when I made the connection between Let's Not Shit Ourselves and Calendar Hung Itself. Because what I think this could mean is a reference to a suicide attempt being a catalyst for starting over. Now, I want to put a huge disclaimer on this. In no way am I advocating for the idea that attempting suicide is a good way to start over. Be that as it may, people have mentioned that after something like that, which again, you never know how it's going to turn out in the end. If you are feeling some sort of way, there's never a guarantee that, okay, well, I'll just wake up tomorrow, right? So this is a minefield to navigate, because there is a very specific way this needs to come off, and one that I am afraid for listeners, like, I hope you understand where I'm coming from in this as a personal interpretation to a personal message that someone wrote. So with this idea that has been documented of, after a traumatic event like that, after a suicide attempt, feeling a new lease on life, like you have a second chance, that is my idea when I talk about the girls bringing water as a symbol of death, but also hope and the perversion of extreme, extreme destitute sadness with, but maybe there's another chance after that. And this idea of, despite the fact everything that brought me to this point, something pulled me from that grass. There were a few days still worth it. Maybe the sun does keep coming up for some unknown reason, and almost like a gratefulness to have gotten that chance. And yeah, so I think that is a challenging idea to get across, again, because I don't want to give people the wrong idea, and I don't want to be seen as giving some sort of license to, yeah, try this, it might work. So please really do heed warnings and, like, be careful with the message that you take from that. This is an anecdote and not a prescription.
And I, as somebody who's not any sort of healthcare professional, I would jump in and also say that the anecdotes that you gave, the thing that you were referencing, only comes from the people who were lucky enough to live through the attempt.
Yes.
And like for every story of somebody who that was their awakening, there are probably too many more tragically who don't have that opportunity. And so for those people who had survived it, they are only able to say that because they made what I'm sure is a bad decision, but were fortunate enough to live through it. And then, I mean, hopefully that should be convincing enough for anybody who would have those thoughts to stop there while they're still thoughts.
Right.
And seek the proper assistance and reach out to the people who can help. And not have to roll the dice and not even have to worry if you'll, you know, come out the other end of that. Don't even go in.
Yeah, and I think what you speak to, and that's a really good way to put it, is survivorship bias. You hear the stories of the ones that survived. So, I think that's a large enough disclaimer on that. But I think that idea is very interesting and maybe far-fetched, and I'm reading too far into it. And again, I want to add the other disclaimer. Character, Connor, not individual. We don't know these things for sure. But I think it is an interesting concept because, and it's one that I'll again reference later for it, but this idea of starting over with that being the activating event.
And one more thing that I wanted to add, because I don't know how much deeper we want to dig into this. And I think that I think the heavy subject matter that we're talking about is sort of the climax of what we're going to be talking about in this section. But it does go hand in hand with what I wanted to talk about, which is not too often do we get little vignettes in the middle of an album. In a lot of Bright Eyes albums, we get like in the opening track, there is some like explicit framing device or story that's happening. And then at the end, we usually get like a nice tie, like a nice bow to tie it up at the end, like some sort of conclusion. Or, I mean, like I'm sure even as I'm saying that, you and I are going to go to like, Casadega, that's where you'll find a center of energy. And then it ends with like the other voicemail messages where we get like Tim Casher jumping in as well. We get like the story being told in the first track. But throughout this song, I had an original interpretation of what's happening in the background, which I may have read from Genius. I read this somewhere, and it might be a false interpretation, but it's the one that I've been kind of sticking with. But since we had this discussion, I might be coming around to a different opinion on what's happening there.
Okay.
So the original thing that I thought was happening in the background is there is a neighbor listening to this song through their wall and trying to shut out the noise, essentially. And it ends with concerned knocking on a door as though something is terribly wrong for the noise to suddenly stop. And my original interpretation, or whatever interpretation I read that like colored how I interpreted this, was that that was the suicide.
Interesting.
Like the peak, the climax of this song is that horrible decision being made. But in our discussion that we're talking about now, it's possible that maybe this is not necessarily the end for this character, but rather they have been discovered, that nothing is final. Maybe this is one of those cases where the person was lucky and survived and they were found. Or if we want to continue being positive and go even further away from that, maybe it's instead of trying to block out the neighbor, this character, and the noise, maybe that's the outreach, that somebody actually took the step to give a shit and to come over and actually talk instead of turning up the TV nice and loud to block out that noise.
I guess off of that, the one thing that I'm not sure where that lands in that, because the whole like a neighbor listening that came directly from the band itself.
Oh yeah.
And it's an intentional choice to have it sound like your annoying neighbor playing music through a very thin wall. But I never thought about like, I figured, okay, the TV plays into that because you're overhearing this and that. But with the knock and everything, but then at the end too, there is
the dial tone
disconnected. Phone that leads into halai, 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 halai that starts with a phone call. Right. So it's almost, it is right where Curious Girl leaves off that halai picks up, pun not intended, because he's actually hanging up the phone at that point. So it's curious. And I wonder, kind of all of these different ideas floating around of, okay, well, maybe something tragic did happen. The phone is at the dial tone, neighbor comes to knock because they were eavesdropping and wants to try to help. Maybe it is reaching out to a concerned friend. Maybe it's the neighbor overhearing this, the Connor on the phone, the dial tone, and then it leads into back into the first person of Connor singing about the phone call that he just got. We took the point of view of this third person, and Halai comes back and pulls us back into Connor's point of view of things as well. There's a lot of different kind of ways that you could see that, I guess.
I'm curious too if there, I feel like we're both using the word curious just because of the title of the song.
Yeah, it's like on our tongue now. And
yeah, it's just like it's in the forefront of our mind, so it's just it's constantly there.
Just make another phone pun and then.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I would, but like I feel like I'd be phoning it in, so.
I'm done. I'm out. Sorry, guys. Podcast over.
All right. I'm doing this one. From here on out, we film without a script. I'm curious if there's now... Fuck, I did it again. I'm curious if there's a connection between like the dial tone and the fact that the next line starts with like pieces of a conversation from a phone call and the fact that there is a potential suicide attempt or at least somebody in a really not good place happening in this song that calls back to I drug your ghosts across the country and we plotted out my death. In every city, memories would whisper, here's where you rest. I was determined in Chicago, but I dug my teeth into my knees and settled for a telephone, sang into your machine. Like, is this a parallel of I'm having dark thoughts? It was going down this way, but now a phone call is going to happen instead.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Especially since like the comparisons, the quasi autobiographical, we'll say, points that you brought up. Again, not confirming, not throwing accusations or however we should put it to the man Connor Oberst, but definitely this character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I definitely see some parallel happening there.
For sure.
A phone call and a sort of desperate hour.
Yeah. And I mean, hell man, we're kind of already blending from very seamlessly. I may add from Curious Girl to Halai, 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 Halai. So why don't we stitch up the last one and start heading into the next?
All right. Let's patch us through to the next song.
Jesse, I'm never going to forgive you for that one. May God have mercy on your soul. But unfortunately, we don't have enough time to dedicate to verbally flogging you in front of the audience. So instead, let's talk about halai, 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 halai. Is that the whole title?
It is, and the spookiest thing about that entire exchange is that I'm pretty sure... Are you reading the transcript from my last therapy session? Because, like, that's exactly how my last therapy session ended.
Yeah, a crazy story. Carol and I, we go way, way back. Met at a Starbucks, actually, and it was a little bit of a meet-cute. Like, you know, we locked eyes from across the room, and turned out we knew you, a mutual contact, and... shortly thereafter began 3 months of the most passion.
You see, we met in a coffee shop and we realized we knew the same loser. And so we banded together to not only have a steamy relationship, but also to make your life a living hell.
Oh, Lord. Well, talk to us about this song, Jesse.
Yes. Let us quickly transition out of this bit. Right. So I think a big note that I have for this one is I had mentioned before curiosity as to how much Tim Casher was involved in this. Mm-hmm. Because my big note here is that I get a lot of cursive vibes from this song. In that when, especially in the vocals, when it's like very raw and screamy, I feel that little bit of harder core stuff slipping into the album. And maybe there was, whether it was like Tim Casher sort of, I don't know whether he had any kind of say in the writing of the music or whether Connor was just like listening to some of the stuff that Tim was doing. I get that feeling. I'm not well-versed in the vocabulary I would need to describe the music. It's a feeling I get. I get a very cursive feeling from this track.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably like a nature versus nurture thing, right? You put two people together for long enough and they probably influence each other in different ways and they just kind of like grow similarly. Even if they don't make the same music, I'm sure there are absolutely influences and ideas that they've borrowed from each other throughout their discographies. My note for this song was this, I think I had mentioned it back on our first episode, our little intro, but this was my first introduction into Bright Eyes.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. Popped open LimeWire, downloaded some songs.
Dodged the porn the whole way.
Yep. And ended up listening to it and not really enjoying it all that much. It just, I couldn't get into the shaky voice. And then I guess as I matured, probably, you know, 3 to 4 months later, as one does.
As all young men do in a very short amount of time and definitely in high school and not well into their 30s.
Hopefully.
You're right.
We're also not well into our 30s, all right? Come on.
We're pushing 40.
Yeah, exactly.
Lordy, lordy, look who's 40. We're definitely cutting half of this shit.
Yeah. I just wish I could Freaky Friday with someone who's like, you know, 28, because I would feel so much younger.
wait, real talk. Have you seen the movie The Switch Up?
Yeah, I have. The Freaky like Friday, but they pee in the same fountain, right?
Yes. And I think that like Ryan Reynolds and
Jason Bateman.
Like, I think they did really, they both did a really good job of like impersonating the other.
Yeah.
So in the matter of like 2 days, you matured into fine wine and then you realized what?
I don't know. I guess something hit differently. You know, I am someone who has definitely grown into the idea that, I guess I want to say that there is no bad art, but I feel like there's a much more nuanced take that I would need to spend more time thinking about.
Mm.
But I guess this is kind of the first time I started to realize that things don't necessarily need to sound beautiful to be good, right? You don't necessarily need to have a classically trained voice in order to make beautiful music, you know? And I think that's something that over time I wore down on as well, and as my musical taste kind of expanded. But for me, this is one of the first times that I didn't like something and then grew to accept it, because, you know what, it might sound different and he may not be the best singer, but there's still so much value there. And I think a lot of people do get turned off by his voice, but if they broaden their horizons a bit, they might find the same thing I did and enjoy the deeper part of the band.
I had a similar experience, I think. And I'm certain we've talked about this in previous episodes, but just the fact that, like you're saying, it doesn't necessarily, you don't need to like something purely based on whether it's perfectly aesthetically pleasing. And I completely sympathize with the challenge that comes with trying to describe what we're saying, because I think the least charitable description of what we're saying is that, like, oh, Connor's got a shitty voice, but we like his lyrics. And mm-hmm. I feel like that's the worst interpretation of what we're trying to say.
Yeah.
I don't think Connor has a perfect voice, but personally, I think he has a great voice, considering what he's saying, how he's saying it, and the music that surrounds it. I think all the pieces of this band work really well to make something really beautiful out of something not conventional.
And absolutely. Yeah.
I don't think it's very charitable to say that he has a bad voice, because, I mean, like, we've listened to him live, and we've certainly talked about this before, but, like, we've seen him at Carnegie Hall, uh-huh. where it's this really prestigious, beautiful venue, and he was just kind of off. And then a week later, we go and see him in a dive bar, and he's immaculate, and he's just rocking out and having a good time. And I think, like, the setting and the surroundings and just the attitude that you go into it definitely changes how you, one, how you make music and art, for that matter, and then also how you perceive it. And I think, you know, if you stick him in a conventional place, he's going to be uncomfortable, or at least, mm-hmm. you know, not really super into it. And then if you throw him in a place where it seems a little more intimate, I can, you know, we've witnessed firsthand how much at ease he is. Although I don't want to speak like I know the guy or anything, but it's just from anecdotal evidence, that's what it seems to me.
I mean, from what we could dig up in the basement and create his FBI psychological profile, that is definitely real and not just something that is made up in TV shows and movies. I actually have no idea, but you know, we've put together a pretty solid psych profile on the guy. Yeah, I mean, I think this song absolutely speaks to that. And I'm not surprised that this grew to be one of the bigger ones on the album, I'd say.
No, I would agree with that as well. Like, yeah. Not surprising at all.
Interestingly, I would say no song on Fevers and Mirrors, and correct me if I'm wrong here, probably reached the heights of, like, Perfect Sonnet. Maybe Halai Halai was the one that was, like, right there with it. I would also say, going back to Calendar Hung Itself, is probably up there as well. But although this album was the one that put them on the map, I don't think that there was a specific song that put them in the zeitgeist. It was the sum of the parts, basically. You know, it's like, this is a catchy song. It's got the perfect amount of, like, melodrama that we talked about with Perfect Sonnet to just, like, really kill during this peak emo era.
Yeah, whereas I think Perfect Sonnet gains a lot of popularity, I think maybe Halai is a little more of a sampler of what Bright Eyes is kind of at its core. So we had spoken previously about how it's sort of difficult to boil Bright Eyes down to essentials, and how it's tempting to say, well, this is an emo band, right? Like, we've had that discussion. Mm-hmm. But I think that this song kind of is a good sampler in that, like, it's got these heavy lyrics. It starts relatively, like, slow and quiet and this, like, moody emo kind of sense. But then you get more into these, like, folky guitar riffs, and it definitely blends, like, a bunch of weird stuff that you wouldn't think worked nicely into something that works really nicely.
Yeah, and I think just the overall concept of, and maybe this could be an incorrect reading of the song, but I think overall this kind of like idea of moving on and putting a relationship to rest, equating that to a funeral, is just like, there's something that is so hyperbolic about that that really, I think, speaks to the irrationality of youth of and those feelings of love when you're younger, right? Like, this is the end of me. This is akin to death, and I must grieve, and there's a period of mourning and loss, et cetera, et cetera. And it's kind of, you know, it's naive in a sense, but I don't want to say naive has a negative connotation that I'm qualifying so that it isn't there. I think it's naive in a sort of almost like a developmental sense, I guess I'd say.
I think that that naivete, which I know that you qualified, but I think that it's what makes the writing of early Bright Eyes really interesting, because it's at the same time super mature and also a little juvenile at the same time. We've got, like, as you said, the equation of a death of a relationship to a funeral is quite interesting. And we've also got, again, sorry that we keep bringing this up, but we did give ample warning. To me, I saw more suicide references, particularly, mm-hmm. like, plans were never finalized but left to hang like yarn and twine, which to me calls back to the string on a spindle kind of
okay.
aftermath of a hanging. At least I can't help but with the opening track, I can't help but equating like strings and threads to the imagery of somebody who had hanged themselves.
Right. May I get in real quick on that?
Mm, yeah.
So I do have that line marked down as well, but my comment was like a puppet, actually.
Ooh.
So left to hang like yarn and twine dangling before my eyes. So that idea of Arionette, the song puppet,
mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I went with it. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that disqualifies the idea, because, you know, this kind of idea of Arionette is very nebulous. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there before we got off the trail.
No, that works too, because also Lifted has a track that covers that kind of thing as well. So I can see this being like the groundwork for threads and strings and rope as imagery of loss of control or that sort of thing. Which, I mean, you could also tie, pun very intended, you could also tie in this element of like a puppet with its strings cut. It's this limp thing, almost corpse-like. I think it's interesting that it speaks to the level of complexity of these lyrics, that we can come to it with such different ideas, but also feel as rewarded for digging into it as we do. I mean, I can't honestly think of too many artists who I listen to that I get this much complexity out of discussing their craftsmanship. However, I guess this is the first time that I've done it in front of a microphone, so.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think, for sure, like, at first blush, I have ideas of what a Bright Eyes song is and the meaning and what that means to me. And I've said it before, I'll say it again, going back into these tracks definitely gives me a different perspective, because you look for things differently, and there are layers. And you know, if you, we don't need to have a death of the author conversation, but this idea that once a work is out, the meaning is no longer determined by the author, but the reader, I think is definitely part of what makes this podcast or just the idea of chatting about theories in general, be it movies, music, books, etc., what makes that so interesting. The, you know, the, and two, like, we can have this conversation without just like, no, you're actually factually incorrect. And I'm sure there are some of those instances where that might be true. Like, someone can have explicit information that discredits one of those things, but I'd just be like, watch this Lindsay Ellis video about death of the author. I don't give a shit.
I was wondering when you were going to bring Lindsay to that one.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Great. It's classic. National treasure.
I do. I mean, also, I thought you were going to go with the angle of, like, you know, there are so many ways that you can interpret any given piece of literature, of art. But when it comes to, you know, you can't argue that Halai is actually about, like, an alien abduction.
Right. You could, oh, of course.
But you'd have to work, like, really, really hard to prove that point. And even then I'd be like, kind of grasping at straws here, friend.
It would be very silly, I think.
You should reach out to us on Twitter and tell us your alien conspiracy theories regarding fevers and mirrors. Did I just ruin our Twitter feed?
Yeah, maybe. So going back into some of the specific lines, so I think the lock of hairline is pretty interesting. The way that I read it is that there was a second chance given at some point in the relationship, which speaks to some sort of betrayal. You know, he says, "You tear and tear your hair from roots. From that same head you have twice removed now, a lock of hair you said would prove our love would never die." So, you know, giving someone a lock of your hair, you know, trying to say that this love is forever. She did it once, something happened, and she did it again. And now she's at the point where she's pulling her hair out in frustration. So I think this is kind of maybe a bit of a new aspect of this relationship that seems to be peppered throughout the album, that there was a second chance and there was some kind of betrayal. However, I don't really think it's mentioned elsewhere on the album. So not going to say it's insignificant, but I wonder if this is just more fuel to the fire of making an emotionally compelling song rather than it being specific to the story that's being told.
The idea of a second chance is interesting to me, because especially if we're gonna ignore the EP and let's think of this as a direct sequel to Letting Off the Happiness, we did have that interesting tension in the last album about perhaps the girl that the protagonist was chasing after versus a poetic retelling of an unfortunate seduction where there's maybe a second person. Maybe this is something of a sequel where perhaps even if it's not explicitly referenced outside of this song, it's still technically in the canon of something that happened. If we're going to assume that this is the same character as we saw from Letting Off the Happiness, I'm curious what you would think of that. Like, do you think that this is a continuation or a reference to that previous plot line?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense the way you put it. I didn't put two and two together. I also wonder, you know, Connor says that some of what he sings about comes from, well, Connor doesn't say that, but in the fake interview, Connor in air quotes does, but you know, this is absolutely true, I'm sure, for his music, that some of what he sings about is his experience and some of it is other people's experience too. So although I think what you say is very, it makes a lot of sense, there's also just that possibility too that he's drawing from another person's experience to kind of, again, like, add to the weight of that song or flesh out this relationship in terms of, like, why it means so much that he would equate losing it to death, you know? Yeah, I think that's really kind of interesting to think about it as a continuation of that relationship, of that story from back on letting out off the happiness, because you do almost see threads eke through with like Perfect Sonnet on Every Day and Every Night. And even if it isn't all perfectly sequential, they do seem to exist in the same space. One of the other lines too was in the second verse with when he talks about the mirror, right?
Yes.
It kind of reminds me back to A Spindle, A Fever, A Darkness, A Necklace. And that idea that I brought up about two people who go in different paths and see the world in different ways, right? And where Connor feels like he's stagnating, he's stuck, and this other person has grown and is moving on. So the idea of painting a mirror blue and putting jewelry tears, it seems like it would naturally create like some kind of sadness. You know, we talked about altering your image back on Neely O'Hara. And you would think that, well, okay, we associate like blue tears with like sadness. But I wonder, and this might be a stretch, if maybe they see blue as like a bright color, a positive. And so what Connor sees when he looks in the mirror, when he sees blue that paints his life, he's seeing sadness, while this other person's like, you know, blue is a happy, it's the color of the sky. So again, I think that might speak back to that idea of diverging thoughts on the same event.
I could absolutely see that as a possible interpretation, especially since as a strictly listening experience without seeing anything, it's easy that we can get roped into the speaker's point of view. Like you said, how the way that it's being told, one would be led to assume that blue is this like grim and dour color. And clearly there are teardrop, you know, plastic rhinestones on this mirror. But I mean, if you want to try to think of it from the other perspective, as you said, like blue doesn't necessarily need to be it's a cool color, but it doesn't need to be a sad color. And if they're just rhinestones with like no particular like teardrop shape, like they could just be plastic gems. And yeah, that's just like one person's perspective and using, you know, taking poetic liberty to describe them. It also brings back the tension of previous songs, or at least, you know, my interpretation of them now that I've listened to the newest album, is how much blame should really be assigned to this other person as opposed to maybe the speaker. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't exactly know the story, and if we're going to be in this much contention as to, you know, a painted mirror, how skeptical should we be of the relationship in the first place?
Yeah, yeah. And I can't remember exactly what point I made, but I kind of mentioned that a lot of this is coming through from a biased narrator. Actually, I think I said it again on the first song, that we have to remember, like, this is not an objective view of how things went down. But I think that subjectivity is what makes, again, this music compelling, right? Because if it was just a pure recounting of what happened without any sort of bias, would it really have the same oomph? And I don't think that there would be. So it definitely does increase the weight of the story, even though we are only really seeing Connor, the character's side of things, which, as we've talked about, isn't necessarily always the rational side of things. And so the last two little points that I have, one is towards the end. So he says, and I sing of awful things, the pleasure that my sadness brings. Again, we talked about that theme of kind of that discomfort with putting himself and putting his life out there, which I think this speaks to directly. I, honestly, I said there's a billion ways that you can read something. Maybe there's like 999 million. Maybe this is like, I'm pretty certain about this one. But then also the end, he says, I talk in the mirror to the stranger that appears, our conversations are circles, et cetera, et cetera. So he's having this like manic conversation with himself and almost like this kind of out of body experience where he sees himself as a stranger. Now, maybe that speaks to something like Neely O'Hara, where you feel like you can't trust your reflection anymore and you are a different person. But it also ultimately ends with the question, you know, he says the choices were given. Now you must live them or just not live. And the question, do you want that? Which is a very chilling way to end this song, which I actually don't think we ever specifically get a resolution to. As I think about it, it's a very powerful image, this kind of ranting and raving into a mirror to yourself, trying to rationalize and talk yourself out of the idea of suicide.
That a couple of your points led me to like the last things that I wanted to talk about for the album, but I do want to touch upon what you said as far as like those last couple of lines and how that lack of closure does seem to be a theme at this point, or to be more proper, a motif of unfinished plot lines, or at least ambiguous ones.
Right.
I'm thinking specifically of the when the curious girl realizes she's under glass, that vignette at the end where mm-hmm. we even had like some differing interpretations of what the whole like background noise of that meant, and the fact that there is no, you know, despite what you might read from interviews and like out, like we'll use a fancy term and we'll say paratextual evidence. Things that are outside.
Yeah, professor, I'm going to need the Webster dictionary definition of that one, please.
So basically, if you were to look at only the evidence given inside of the album, like you didn't read interviews, you only looked at what was in the text of the album, you would have a hard time really wrapping your head around what the knocking at the end of that song was supposed to mean. Which I think the ambiguity helps, because it leads me to my next, or rather last point, which is a line that I found very interesting, or like a stanza that I found very interesting, was, you said you hate my suffering, and you understand, and you'd take care of me. You'd always be there. Well, where are you now? From one perspective, from the speaker's perspective, that is the betrayal. The fact that, like, he found somebody that understood his pain, and then suddenly they left.
Mm-hmm.
But you can kind of see it from the other side of maybe somebody who saw a person that was, like, deeply, deeply sad, wanted to help, and then maybe it was not so much betrayal, but a sense that this is too much of a task for me to handle. And given the heaviness of the song, I can kind of see that other perspective where if you hate my suffering, but I'm also kind of the person who performs the suffering or makes art out of it, it can sometimes be hard to let go. And so at what point do you just sort of have to accept if that suffering is part of that person? Is there a time where you just kind of give up and for your own good have to leave that situation?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we kind of talked about the unfairness of wanting women to fix and save you.
Mm, yes.
And I think that idea speaks directly to that, which, you know, is a trope very much baked into just like our culture in general. That, you know, we definitely grew up with, and I think people are affected by in varying ways. I'm not saying every single man on this planet fell victim to that idea. But I think the point you made speaks directly to that. You know, you said you'd always be there. Well, where are you? And this kind of, at a certain point, the onus needs to be on our character, our narrator, to change, to reflect and grow. And I think some of that is there on this album. I know that we struggle to find what is it exactly that Connor does to pull himself from that pit. You know, you kind of talk to like, where is the work being done earlier? And, you know, and maybe at the end of the day, the relationship failed because, you know, he wasn't putting in the work. And we kind of don't see that in the album because maybe Connor was blind to it at the end of the day.
That's true. I mean, we don't see maybe an accurate representation of the other side because that's difficult to do, especially like given the tone of this album. Very much wrapped up in one's own suffering and trying to work through like one's own psychological pain. Sometimes it's difficult to see it from the other side. Yeah, I mean, that's about all I had for this track, which is funny considering that we're like 10 minutes shy of an hour talking about this track. Oh, that's all we had to say an hour later.
Well, the good news for the people listening at home is a good chunk of that will be pared down. It'll still be hefty, but yeah, good chunk of it will be pared down. But yeah,
we're going to have to cut out the part where we talk about that Freaky Friday remake, but right?
Maybe we leave it in just to make this joke land even harder.
Right, exactly. In my arrogance, I thought we were going to cut it, but no, you poor listener, you had to hear all of it.
Oh well, yeah, let's move on. We still got a couple more tracks and our wrap up to do. And we got some meaty ones on the way.
We're not making it through another track, are we?
So, with that said, let's go. Center of the World.
I'm going to be honest. While I find the song very lyrically interesting, this is one of those songs that, while I love all the songs on the album, I don't know. This one doesn't rank too high in my book. I'm curious to see what you think. I just maybe I'm showing my bias towards slower songs again, but like we've got that very screamo cursive style song leading into something that's like very simmering and mellow, but still does build ultimately to something louder. I don't know. I don't know if I'm like doing justice to like why the song doesn't like truly do it for me totally, if that makes any sense.
Wow, Jesse, rave reviews. Great way to start off the freaking track, huh? Get a load of this guy, huh? Well,
the newspaper spins up. Hack fraud sent to jail for slander.
I respectfully disagree. And here's why. So I do think that a change in pace is good. You know, we were really at a high point, but I think you could make the argument too that Halai is very energetic, very frenetic. How's that?
That's a good one.
Yeah, thank you. I thought of that all by myself. New word I just made up.
Shakespeare over here.
Yeah. And so was Sunrise Sunset. So maybe you could make the argument that Center of the World should keep that energy. But I think the feeling of slowing down and then going to this buildup at the end, it still kind of fits. But I do understand what you mean. I do really like the song, but maybe it could also depend on how we listen to music, right? If you are the kind of person that will generally listen to an album all the way through to hear songs, maybe that's why it doesn't fit as well. You know, I obviously will listen to an album all the way through the first couple times, but after that, it's like I'm pulling out select songs. And Center of the World is one that definitely I pull out. So it removes it from the context of what came before and what came after, if that makes sense.
It totally does. And actually, now that you're saying this, it's I'm having this realization now that when I want to listen to certain songs, I tend to start with songs that occur very early in albums, if not the first song. So in a weird way, I inadvertently end up listening to whole albums at a time. So I guess that kind of does make sense considering my listening habits. Like, even if I'm in the if I'm in the mood to listen to Four Winds or something, I'll usually start with To Kill or Be Killed. Like, just to start, like, I just want to listen from the start of the album, even if it's just the first track in after that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, the way you listen to music, whether it be playlists, full albums, shuffling an entire discography, like however you do it, I think that definitely shapes the way that you listen. Because the four singles leading up to Down in the Weeds, I know that One and Done I know that Mariana Trench precedes One and Done, and so it felt natural on the album. But because Forced Convalescence and Persona Non Grata are staggered, it felt weird transitioning into a different song because that wasn't what I was used to, you know?
Right.
But yeah, a very big tangent. And I don't think we've yet to say anything about Center of the World. I'll bring us there. So I think I may have mentioned this whenever I first mentioned that, like, Girl on Display idea, but that, you know, I think the statue of the girl is another example of that, of figuratively putting a girl on a pedestal. But if it's a statue, there's some sort of pedestal I'm sure it's standing on as well physically. And so he says she's standing near a well with a bucket bare and dry. So I wonder again if this is the person he compares himself to on Spindle Fever Darkness Necklace. And when he says that the bucket is bare and dry, but next to a well. So again, my theory that water throughout this album is akin to death. I wonder if the well is a well of, like, these traumas, events that they both shared. Her bucket is bare because she did not carry with her, or at least seemingly to Connor, has not carried those with her, and instead has been able to grow and move on, as I've said multiple times, whereas Connor is not. He is absolutely drenched in these traumas and these events because he hasn't been able to move on. So when she turns him into sand, he says that it's a clumsy form. And I wonder if it's because he feels like he doesn't know how to live, how to exist without his depression, because that's who he is at this point. That's how he knows how to live his life, as sad and angry and frustrated and bitter. So if there was someone that was attempting to change that and move you from that, you would, I feel like, naturally be resistant to the idea.
I can see that as well, especially since I think there's this interesting thing that you're bringing up, as far as if we're going to continue with water as death and then extend that to death being a consequence of these negative emotions, of this depression, of this, like, self-harm in a way. And if you take something to use kind of a childish image, right, like a sandcastle, which, you know, doesn't stand up with dry sand. You need wet sand.
Mm.
And if you remove that water, you lose the shape.
Yeah.
The fact that if you remove this element of yourself, like, even if it's a negative part of yourself, as you had said previously, like, is that then some weird manufactured version of you? Is it a false version of you because this depression, this sadness, this anger was such a big part of you does that give it the right to be you? And I can see that being very traumatic for somebody who is trying to let go of those things, or maybe in the case of medication is having those things removed from them.
And there's one other thing too, sorry, that I forgot to mention that goes along with that just before we potentially move on from that thought. So after that, he says when he is turned into sand, we sat and waited for the sea to stretch out so that we could disappear into the endlessness of blue. It reminds me of the lines in Arionette, we'll mend up together in a dark and distant place. And if it's going to sweep, I'll use the word from Arionette, the desperate, and it's going to sweep them into the water and pull them into this endlessness. It feels very much like an idea of an eternal afterlife, an eternal death.
If the end goal of all of this is to like follow that running water to that deep, dark place, or if you want to follow it to the sea, right, which is a vast, like, as it said, into the endlessness of blue. I'm curious if it's why then we're led back to a body of water. If that, is it that desperation to go back to the water, which represents that death, that sorrow, that depression? Does that imply that the character of the story isn't cut out for this kind of thing, and it will inevitably end up back at that source? Or do you think that there's some sort of transformation that happens with the water, similar-ish to how the necklace of sweat is represented in the first song, where like it's a source of pride, even if it's associated with those things?
I guess I take it more as a literal thing, where reaching the body of water, reaching the endlessness of blue is like the river Styx, right? It is the passageway to the afterlife. Because even after that, he says, into the horror of the truth, we are far less than we knew. Yeah, we are far less than we knew. And it feels maybe conflicting, but this idea of having knowledge of what happens when you die, while Connor subsequently believing that there is nothing that happens when you die, right? Because if you are going to know, if you are going to understand the horror of the truth, that the human race and each individual person is insignificant in it all, that would seem to imply that there is something afterwards, some form of consciousness afterwards for you to know that. But we know, especially from the second song in the album, it's an idea that Connor wrestles with and he doesn't necessarily think is true, even if maybe he has a little bit of hope that he might at least know the answers of the universe at the end of it all. So I guess going back to your original question, I see this as a literal death, a transition into whatever comes after, whether there is some actual consciousness or it's just that your energy fuels the earth in some way.
And I see like bits and pieces of like both of those elements, as far as like the material essence of living, but then also that more spiritual side of things. Like both the idea that we're living, breathing things that exist in the world, and also the idea of reconciling with the fact that there may be some way to perceive things after the body dies. I find it interesting how there's the couple of lines about basically the creation of tombstones paired with fresh sangria and lemon tea, and then the little children in the choir, white robed and small voices, praise him, meaning God. Right. It goes back to that idea of the character Connor and his disdain and jealousy even for people with faith. And so you've got that interesting pairing of like the sweetness and the physicality of life, but then also the spiritual side that he's still grappling with, that he still has a hard time reconciling or maybe even believing. And I think that that fits nicely with this theory of seeing water not only as those elements of despair and such, but also as this pathway to understanding, or like the natural conclusion of a journey where you do have understanding of everything that happened and it all led to this one place. And maybe this is the closest thing that this character has to a religion, the certainty that it, that all of this leads to one place where there is understanding. And it might not be God or an afterlife or heaven, but at least a place where this character and love can be and start to understand that mystery.
You know, something that's really interesting too about this song, and maybe you get the same vibe, I always feel like he is describing a dream in the beginning, despite the fact that there is nothing that indicates it as a dream. I mean, it's obviously a story, but I guess because I have typically tried to listen to these in a very literal and real perspective, that describing a beach with a statue near a well, like it is all, it's very scenic. It's very dreamlike. And I'm actually just kind of realizing now when looking over the lyrics, like there's nothing in there that's explicitly says that. But at the same time, you kind of have this play later on about play on being awake and being asleep. Right? Because this line is, it's one of those lines, you know what I mean? Any Connor fan knows what I mean when I say one of those lines. So in the middle of the day, when you drive home to your place, from that job that makes you sleep back to the thoughts that keep you awake. That those two lines, from the job that makes you sleep back to the thoughts that keep you awake, it's like it's just so perfectly, so succinct in the way that it phrases, like how the boring dystopia of your job zones you out into thinking about those dark thoughts, and those dark thoughts that you have when you are trying to sleep, and just like this juxtaposition of how they're there when you need to focus and stay awake and you drift off, but also every time you try to drift off, they're there waiting for you. So you can't escape them no matter what you try to do. Sleep is no escape, and trying to live is no escape from those thoughts. It's a sleeper for like one of the best lines on the album.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that but we go back to Neely O'Hara and this idea of like an addiction to sleeping pills. And I think this line is, it does in a couple of lines what that whole song was trying to achieve, in that I think those two lines show why somebody would be addicted to that kind of substance, where the one thing in your life that would drone you off to sleep, you can't go to sleep in, right? Like you can't just sleep on the job. You can't just sleep in your boring everyday life. But then when you get home and you have a chance to like rest, and that's when your mind kicks on and you start thinking of all those things that do keep you up. And I mean, the ending of the song, I think, kind of reflects that as well, in that there's that really dangerous side of substance abuse, of a horrible mistake being made, and the fallout of that.
Yeah. And I read that as, you know, I don't necessarily think that we are going in chronological order with these songs. If like, if this is all one linear story, which, you know, truthfully, it very well may not be. But this could be the attempt, right? Because, again, like going back to Let's Not Shit Ourselves, he says, I awoke in relief. My sheets and tubes were all tangled, weak from whiskey and pills. Now, you know, when he says two pills just weren't enough in this song, one of two things. Either like that is him saying like, okay, the antidepressants weren't enough to stop me from doing this, like two Prozac weren't enough.
Gotcha.
Or maybe he's saying like two sleeping pills weren't enough to get me to sleep, so I'm going to take even more now. And after that is when he can no longer wake up, and you know that's potentially it, unless there is some form of divine intervention that saves him from this fate that he has no control over at this point.
And it, I guess it would be kind of dangerous at this point to say like this is that survivor bias, right, where the divine intervention happens basically in that he was lucky enough, the character, let's not throw aspersions, like this character was lucky enough to live through the mistake that they made. And whether the mistake was thinking that taking too many pills to end it was a good idea, or the honest mistake of I was being stupid with a substance and I'm just lucky to have lived through it. I think that's an interesting way of seeing it as divine intervention, like just the fortune of not going through with it.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point too. A good one to that. I have made the assumption of intention throughout, and it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, just because you have suicidal thoughts or ideation doesn't necessarily mean intent, or even intent in this specific instance too. You know, I definitely think it's fair to say this got out of control. I had trouble sleeping, so I started taking one, and then I grew tolerant and I started taking two, and then I had a really bad night and whoops, I took more than I realized. And so now I guess regardless of how it happened, the focus will become that divine intervention and what can change after that. And, you know, going back to this idea of working for the turnaround in this album, you know, you can definitely, I think it's fair to make the argument that it wasn't like there, we don't get it in this album, this one foot in front of the other, I'm going to take it day by day and we're going to get better. But there is a turnaround in the sense of if there is some form of divine intervention that keeps him alive, that at least this is the first step and the catalyst for him to say, you know what, I'm done feeling like a skeleton, no more sleepwalking dead, and just wants to grow from this point. I think, again, I don't necessarily think that the songs have to go chronologically, but yeah, this is a very, very heavy end to a song for sure. And again, another song where we're left with a question almost. We're left hanging like yarn and twine. The plans that were never finalized.
Yeah, and I think the cliffhangerness of it. Here, see, I'm competing with you. I'm making up new words too. I think that works in the way that if we're not going to view these songs as strictly chronological, then we know that there's a chance that this is referencing the previous mistakes that were referenced before, and that there's this gut-wrenching moment where you feel that fear and that terror for this character, but with kind of the safety of knowing that they're making it out the other side. I'm not going to say that it was irresponsible to like suggest that, you know, there was some sort of safety in it the whole time, but just the fact that the song builds so eloquently to that moment that you can still feel that fear despite sort of knowing that the story is going to continue or that there were other parts of the story that we already know happened, if that makes any kind of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know, I feel like in less capable hands that would come off as like a little cheap or like you're, you know, taking advantage of the audience in some way. But I think here it works in that at this point we should have a thorough understanding of this character and of the general story, even if we don't get the specifics. And I think that it's a good cliffhanger ending in that it lets us picture what happened between that moment and all the other songs that we've listened to so far. And that would ultimately, on a re-listen, color how we listen to the other songs, knowing this.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think part of that safety, I'm just going to say it, I think part of it comes because it's a very simple jump to say this is Connor's autobiography, right? Mm. You know, this is everything he's saying is specific and true and happened to him. And therefore, there's a safety in knowing that because he is still writing it,
right?
That at least I know, even if it's not positive, at least it doesn't end in the worst possible of ways, which I think is another interesting thing to think about, both in terms of any kind of autobiographical song or piece of media, but then also with how we choose to engage with the music in the lyrics and in the assumption that it is all Connor and everything is written from specific events that he lived. But yeah, I mean, Center of the World, we kind of spent a lot longer talking about this than I would have thought, truth be told. But I think we're getting to a point where really each song adds so much to the story in maybe not so overt ways.
I do want to jump in and agree that I think your idea that these don't necessarily need to be chronological pieces builds the way that you just described, that there are all these little pieces that sort of reaffirm that comforting notion that even though things get grim and dark, it doesn't end in the worst way possible, as you said. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's this very interesting through line of all of these things happening that with these little pieces of the story, we get something of a learning experience from this character and a story that builds that narrative of maybe like a cautionary tale, that while it's not the happiest of stories, we at least take comfort in knowing that it comes from a person who is aware enough and maybe regretful enough to want to turn that into a story of some sort. And it gives like this idea of what's the authorial intent? What mm-hmm. does this writer want you to walk away thinking? And I highly doubt anybody who would write something like this would just say the moral of the story is like, fuck it, it doesn't matter. Or, you know, like we're all going to die. I think the fact that the character still lives, and that, as you're saying, if we're going to believe this to be very autobiographical, that Connor still lives, I don't think then the point is, fuck it, it doesn't matter. I think the point is, like, yes, it clearly matters, and that's why I'm doing this.
I think that's really, really well put there. This wouldn't exist if it wasn't important in some way, as uncomfortable as it is for Connor to put out this music that is so personal to him, he does it ultimately, and you know, maybe this is a little taste of what's to come later on in the album. But it is something that is important to him to connect with others. But how's about we move on to Sunrise Sunset? You ready?
Yeah, let's head to it.
Hey guys, Chris again. I know you're probably sick of hearing my voice, but good news, you get to hear even more of it. Yeah, this was only part two of three, so you're gonna want to make sure you move on to the next one. I know that you're listening to it in one giant chunk of time, kind of like a Lord of the Rings, Day of the Rings type of thing. So enjoy, and we'll catch you on the next episode.